All right, so I'd like to move along. Now, you're going to cover elsewhere in your BGD course and in other parts of the course the entire birth process and the physiology of birth, but I thought I should, at least to be complete in terms of the events and development, cover some aspects of it in this class. Thank you. And I suppose the events that I'd like to discuss are the ones that correlate with the interactions you'd have clinically. So there are a range of hormonal effects that you can induce labour, you can help maturation of the lungs, and I want to explain some of the endocrine basis for that. So this first image here is a model made back in 1770 to help train midwives to understand the birth process. And there's a series of them, if you go to Florence, available in the Science Museum there, all life-size and showing different stages of childbirth and abnormalities in childbirth. The first phase, which is dilatation here, and you've already been through this in other classes, is the dilatation of the cervix. The second phase is expulsion, and that's pushing the neonate out. By increased contractility of the smooth muscle of the wall of the uterus. The third phase is the pushing out of the placenta, and the placenta has to separate from the uterine wall. The entire placenta has to be removed. If any of it remains, then they have to go back in and remove that physically. And my usual joke that I put into every class, the final stage, stage four recovery, takes a good 20, 25 years, depending upon how long the kids stay at home. So the recovery period in this case is describing the changes in the maternal physiology after the birth. And this required is continued contraction of the smooth muscle in the uterus, bringing it back down to its pre-pregnant size, and contraction of the spiral arteries to prevent excessive bleeding. I remind you that childbirth used to be the major cause of death amongst women from the beginning of last century for thousands of years. Just until recently it's not been. The alternative method of delivery, caesarean, named after the supposed method of delivery of Caesar, is a surgical procedure in the abdominal wall. I'll mention to you that the World Health Organization recommended rate for caesarean deliveries, and caesareans are called for a range of abnormal conditions, difficult breech deliveries, abnormalities of the fetus, and so on. The rate should be somewhere between 10 and 15% to account for these difficult deliveries. And the statistics in Australia for 2007 showed you that the rate of caesareans in Australia was about 31%. And this rate has been gradually climbing over time as well. So we're significantly almost twice as much as the recommended World Health Organization rate of caesarean delivery. Now the changes in hormones that are occurring prior to delivery, can I get you to be a bit more quiet down there? We've got competing endocrine effects. During majority of the pregnancy, progesterone inhibits the contractility of the smooth muscle and allows the pregnancy to continue. So it makes the smooth muscle, usually when you stretch a smooth muscle fibre, its normal response is to contract against the stretch, as we see in the smooth muscle of arterial walls. You stretch an artery, it'll contract back against that pressure. So this progesterone will inhibit this, and I've given you an example of how it does so at the cellular level. The other hormone, estrogen, increases the sensitivity of the smooth muscle to contraction. So just before birth, we get a vast increase in estrogens as well, sensitizing the smooth muscle, beginning to allow it to contract. Similarly, we get secretion of oxytocin and prostaglandins. Prostaglandins not only increase the contractility of the smooth muscle, they're involved in the maturation of the lungs. And so postnatally, prostaglandins are occasionally given to premature infants for respiratory development. In terms of the time in which delivery occurs, the peak period for human delivery is when it's the quietest, about 3 a.m. in the morning, and it's shown in other species that it's usually a quiet and undisturbed surroundings which is the optimal time for when delivery will occur. Something may be occurring like that for us as well. The first diagnostic tool you have for this newborn infant is a very simple one, and it is just simply measuring the weight of the neonate. So what is the birth weight of our newborn infant? And we can categorise the weights into different classes, which I've shown in this table here. The extremely low birth weights, which we see with a lot of very premature infants, is less than 500 grams or up to 999 grams. So the primary cause of this very low birth weight is early gestation, often down to about as low as 30 weeks gestation will have these very low birth weights. Then as you go from there, above a kilo to 1.5 kilos is still considered to be a very low birth weight. And above 1.5 kilos to just under 2.5 is a low birth weight. So all of these weights down here correspond with the theory that I've told you about already, which is the fetal origins hypothesis, and that is that a low birth weight may be indicative of a failure of fetal growth or a failure to thrive, which may correlate with abnormalities in systems that aren't obvious. And more recently, clinically, they've been able to correlate low birth weights with a range of other postnatal health problems, such as asthma, diabetes, other non-specific or not related to birth, but programmed in that prenatal period. It's called the fetal origins hypothesis, or Barker's hypothesis is what it used to be called. The normal birth weights from 2.5 kilos all the way up to 4. And then we have the high birth weights above 4 kilos. Seems to be a trend for increasing birth weights in Australia. But above 4 kilos, and this is called macrosomia as well, and can often be seen in a mother who's had uncontrolled diabetes during the pregnancy. We often sometimes get males to the upper end of the normal birth weight to the high birth weight as well. So that's birth. I'd like to now talk about the neonatal period. The time just after birth is described as the perinatal period. So those first day or two after birth, the perinatal. And the neonatal extends to the first 4 weeks of development, or the first month postnatally. Sometimes described in the general public as the newborn period as well, but neonatal and perinatal are more accurate descriptions of these times. Now, Christopher here, who I'd like to point out, this is my 19-year-old son now. I always like to show naked pictures of him lying here just after birth. This is his perinatal period. He's being weighed. He's had his cord clamped. And this newborn infant has to change a whole range of systems at birth. And the changes that are occurring at birth are those required to maintain homeostasis, and that is the balance internally of the fetal system's physiology. And the systems that have to be altered are the lung function. They need to change from secretory to absorptive. They were filled with liquid before birth. Circulation has to change. We have to shut down the 3 vascular shunts which bypass the pulmonary circulation in the fetus. Those need to be closed at this time, and abnormalities in the circulatory system can become obvious at birth if they hadn't been detected previously. Thermoregulation, it doesn't seem like an important feature, but prior to this, all of development occurred in a nice 37-degree bath for 9 months, and now the environment outside of the mother's uterus is a lot colder, and this brings rise to the endocrine changes as well. In the newborn infant, has a large amount of what's known as brown adipose, shown in this diagram here, which is different from white adipose, shown above it. Brown adipose can be rapidly metabolized to generate heat and energy, unlike white adipose, which just accumulates around my waist and won't move at all. So I'd like to transform that rapidly to brown adipose if I could. The idea is that that brown adipose can generate heat and energy for the newborn infant and has been laid down in that third trimester. Endocrine changes. The placenta is no longer providing all of the endocrine support to the fetus, so the neonate has its own endocrine functions changing. I mentioned to you that the adrenal gland continues to develop postnatally up to 3 years of age before we see one of the layers of the cortex forming. Nutrition, the whole GIT has to be activated to allow absorption of nutrition through the gut, and one of the other major roles of the gut at this stage, postnatally, is the absorption of maternal antibodies from the maternal milk through the gut wall. So passive immunization through maternal milk through the gut wall. Waste production and the kidney function. The kidneys were functioning prenatally, but of course they've got a larger load and a change of load. I'll mention to you that if the fetus is stressed during the delivery period or prior to the delivery, it can release the contents of its bowel before birth, and this meconium, the first excretion after birth, can then fill the amniotic sac, be swallowed by the fetus, and damage the lungs. So this fetal stress before birth can lead to meconium syndrome. At birth, there's a simple test that can be carried out called Apgar test. It monitors a range of variables which can be measured: activity, pulse, grimace, appearance, and respiration. A score is given for each one of those components, and if the score is between 7 and 10, it's considered normal at delivery. It's measured twice at two different time points. If it's 4 to 7, there may be resuscitation required for the infant, and if it's down below 3, it requires immediate resuscitation. This is a historic tool. It was thought that it didn't have much application in modern times, but it's a very simple tool to apply to the newborn infant and correlates very well, so it's used in a lot of circumstances. The second type of test is carried out a bit later on, the Guthrie test, whereby blood is spotted out into these circles. Was developed some time ago by Robert Guthrie to detect phenylketonuria, which is a metabolic disorder. These days we test a range of other disorders in addition to PKU, and in New South Wales we tend to test for hyperthyroidism and cystic fibrosis as well, and in other countries a range of other abnormalities can be checked as well. I mentioned also that in New South Wales and Victoria, your Guthrie cards are kept indefinitely. So there's somewhere somebody has a sample of your blood which they can clone you out of later on. The last thing I want to mention today is to describe abnormalities of development in relation to the statistics in Australia. Almost finished. And what I've listed here are from a Victorian report for 2003 and 4, and these represent the top 10 abnormalities at birth in sequence. The most common one is hyperspadia. It's a male external genital abnormality where the urethral folds don't fuse and we get the urethra opening on the inferior side of the penis. It's the most common male abnormality and most common birth abnormality. It's followed up by defects of the kidney development, where we get a blockage of the outflow of the kidney, and this blockage can be so serious that it can lead to, in some instances, terminations if it can't be resolved. Heart defects, ventricular septal defects, There are defects associated with the hip. This one down here is a congenital dislocation of the hip. The hips can be dislocated in the fetus or during the birth itself through the birth canal, but the vast majority of them get dislocated by you guys here in this room as you're carrying out the test to see if the hips are dislocated. You flex the hips and dislocate the hips. So it's quite common postnatally for the hips to be dislocated while you're testing for hip dislocation. So we see congenital musculoskeletal abnormalities. We see genetic abnormalities, trisomy 21, trisomy 18 further down here. Neurological abnormalities, hydrocephalus, the increased volume of the liquid space of the brain associated with neural tube defects or other neural development defects. Cleft palate and cleft lip. Notice that there are two entries for the clefting of the upper palate, and that is because the palate fuses at two different time points and in two different ways. During the embryonic period, we form the primary palate by fusion of the maxilla with the philtrum from the frontonasal prominence or the medial nasal regions here to form the upper jaw. If this doesn't fuse during the embryonic period, we're left with that cleft we saw in the ultrasound, and the cleft can either be unilateral or bilateral clefting of the lip. And if it occurs, then that's occurred during the embryonic period. When we go later in development, you'll see that when we looked at the end of the embryonic period, the palatal shelves need to fuse in the fetal period. If the palatal shelves don't fuse later on, then we get clefting of the palate inside the oral cavity, and that would occur at a different time during the fetal period. When the lip is cleft, cleft dead, then it will lead to clefting of the later forming palate as well, because it needs to fuse anteriorly with the lip. So if the lip is clefted, then it will allow clefting to run back into the palate because it won't be able to fuse in correctly as well. And that's why we have two separate entries for the palate. The last one down here at number 9 is another kidney abnormality. Basically, the systems which take the longest to develop and the most complex to develop are the ones we see problems with. And this pie diagram up here breaks down all of the Australian's data into the major system abnormalities. And this is musculoskeletal in red, heart in blue, genital, chromosomal, the nervous system here in grey, cleft lip and palate, and the limbs. Together, these disorders occupy 75% of all of the major birth abnormalities we see in Australian statistics. I'll finish there. You've got a minute or two to ask the tutors some questions on the last bit of material. Thanks very much for your attention, everyone.